The oldest building in Heraklion will outlive the newest building in America. Organisms die. The cell lives on. Life is at the roots, embedded in simplicity, asserting itself uniquely. I called regularly at the vice consul's home for my bowl of rice. Sometimes he had visitors. One evening, the head of the Merchant Tailors Association dropped in. He had lived in America and spoke a quaint, old-fashioned English. "Gentlemen, will you have a cigar?" he would say. I told him I had been a tailor myself once upon a time. "But he's a journalist now," the vice consul hastily put in. "He's just read my book." I began to talk about alpaca sleeve linings, basting, soft roll lapels, beautiful vicunas, flap pockets, silk vests, and braided cutaways. I talked about these things madly for fear the vice consul would divert the conversation to his pet obsession. I wasn't quite sure whether the boss tailor had come as a friend or as a favored menial. I didn't care. I decided to make a friend of him, if only to keep the conversation off that infernal book which I had pretended to have read, but which I couldn't stomach after page 3. "Where was your shop, gentlemen?" asked the tailor. "On Fifth Avenue," I said. "It was my father's shop." "Fifth Avenue. That's a very rich street, isn't it?" he said, whereupon the vice consul pricked up his ears. "Yes," I said. "We had only the best customers. Nothing but bankers, brokers, lawyers, millionaires, steel and iron magnates, hotel keepers, and so on." "And you learned how to cut and sew?" he said. "I could only cut pants," I answered. "Coats were too complicated." "How much did you charge for a suit, gentlemen?" "Oh, at that time we asked only $100 or $125. He turned to the vice consul to ask him to calculate what that would be in drachmas. They figured it out. The vice consul was visibly impressed. It was a staggering sum in Greek money, enough to buy a small ship. I felt that they were somewhat skeptical. I began talking carload lots about telephone books, skyscrapers, ticker tape, paper napkins, and all the paraphernalia of the big city, which makes the yokel roll his eyes as if he'd seen the Red Sea opening up. The ticker tape arrested the tailor's attention. He had been to Wall Street once to visit the stock exchange. He wanted to speak about it. He asked me diffidently if there weren't men in the street who ran their own little markets. He began making deaf and dumb signs, as they used to do in the curb market. The vice consul looked at him as if he was slightly touched. I came to his rescue. "Of course there were such men, thousands of them, all trained in this special deaf and dumb language," I asserted vigorously. I stood up and made a few signs myself to demonstrate how it was done. The vice consul smiled. I said I would take them inside the stock exchange on the floor itself. I described that madhouse in detail, ordering myself slices of Anaconda Copper, Amalgamated Tin, Tell and Tell, anything I could remember of that crazy Wall Street past, whether volatile, combustible, or analgesic. I ran from one corner of the room to the other, buying and selling like a maniac, standing at the vice consul's commode and telephoning my broker to flood the market, calling my banker to make a loan of $50,000 immediately, calling the telegraph jakes to take a string of telegrams, calling the grain and wheat trusters in Chicago to dump a load in the Mississippi, calling the Secretary of the Interior to inquire if he had passed that bill about the Indians, calling my chauffeur to tell him to put a new spare tire on the back behind the rumble seat, calling my shirtmaker to curse him for making the neck too tight on the pink and white shirt, and what about my initials? I ran across the street and gobbled a sandwich at the exchange buffet. I said hello to a friend of mine who was going upstairs to his office to blow his brains out. I bought the racing edition and stuck a carnation in my buttonhole. I had my shoes shined while answering telegrams and telephoning with the left hand. I bought a few thousand railroad stocks absent-mindedly and switched to Consolidated Gas on a hunch that the new pork barrel bill would improve the housewife's lot. I almost forgot to read the weather report. Fortunately, I had to run back to the cigar store to fill my breast pocket with a handful of Corona Coronas. And that reminded me to look up the weather report to see if it had rained in the Ozark region. The tailor was listening to me goggle-eyed. "That's the truth," he said excitedly to the vice consul's wife, who had just made another bowl of soggy rice for me. And then suddenly it occurred to me that Lindbergh was coming back from Europe. I ran for the elevator and took the express to the 109th floor of a building that hadn't been built yet. I ran to the window and opened it. The street was choked with frantically cheering men, women, boys, girls, horse cops, motorcycle cops, ordinary cops, thieves, bulls, plainclothesmen, farmers, lawyers, acrobats, thugs, bank clerks, floor walkers, anything with pants or skirts on. Anything that could cheer, holler, whistle, stamp, murder, or evaginate. Pigeons were flying through the canyon. It was Broadway. It was the year something or other, and our hero was returning from his great transcontinental flight. I stood at the window and cheered until I was hoarse. I don't believe in aeroplanes, but I cheered anyway. I took a drink of rye to clear my throat. I grabbed a telephone book. I tore it to pieces like a crazed hyena. I grabbed some ticker tape. I threw that down on the fly specs. Anaconda copper, amalgamated zinc, U.S. steel. 57.5, 34, 138, minus 2, plus 6.75, 51. Going up, going higher. Atlantic coastline, seaboard airline. Here he comes. He's coming. That's him. That's Lindbergh. Hooray, hooray, some guy. The eagle of the sky. A hero. The greatest hero of all time. I took a mouthful of rice to quiet myself. "How high is the tallest building?" asked the vice consul. I looked at the tailor. "You answer it," I said. He guessed about 57 stories. I said, 142, not counting the flagpole. I stood up again to illustrate. Best way is to count the windows. The average skyscraper has roughly 92,546 windows back and front. I undid my belt and put it on again clumsily as if I were a window cleaner. I went to the window and sat on the sill outside. I cleaned the window thoroughly. I unhooked myself and went to the next window. I did that for 4.5 hours, making roughly 953 windows clean, scraped, and waterproof. "Doesn't it make you dizzy?" asked the tailor. "No, I'm used to it," I said. I was a steeplejack once, after I quit the merchant tailoring business. I looked at the ceiling to see if I could do any demonstrating with the chandeliers. "You'd better eat your rice," said the vice consul's wife. I took another spoonful by way of politeness and absent-mindedly reached for the decanter in which there was the cognac. I was still excited about Lindbergh's homecoming. I forgot that actually, on that day when he landed at the Battery, I was digging a ditch for the park department in the county of Catawba. The commissioner was making a speech at a bowling club, a speech I had written for him the day before. The vice consul was completely at home now in the new world. He had forgotten about his contribution to life and letters. He was pouring me another drink. "Had the gentleman tailor ever gone to a ball game?" I inquired. He hadn't. "Well, he surely must have heard of Christy Mathewson or Walter Johnson." He hadn't. "Had he ever heard of a spitball?" He hadn't. "Or a home run?" He hadn't. I threw the sofa cushions around on the parlor floor. First, second, third base, and home plate. I dusted the plate with the napkin. I put on my cage. I caught a fast one right over the plate. "Strike." "Two more and he's out," I exclaimed. I threw off the mask and ran toward the infield. I looked up through the roof and I saw the ball dropping out of the planet Pluto. I caught it with one hand and threw it to the shortstop. "He's out," I said. "It was a fly." "Three more innings to go. Have our little popcorn. Have a bottle of pop then." I took out a package of spearmint and I stuck a rib in my throat. "Always buy Wrigley's," I said. "It lasts longer. Besides, they spend $5,963 a year for advertising. Gives people work. Keeps the subways clean. How about the Carnegie Library? Would you like to pay a visit to the library? 5,698,000 circulating subscribers. Every book thoroughly bound, filed, annotated, fumigated, and wrapped in cellophane. Andrew Carnegie gave it to the city of New York in memory of the Homestead riots. He was a poor boy who worked his way to the top. He never knew a day of joy. He was a very great millionaire who proved that it pays to work hard and save your pennies. He was wrong, but that doesn't make any difference. He's dead now, and he left us a chain of libraries which makes the working people more intelligent, more cultured, more informed. In short, more miserable and unhappy than they ever were, bless his heart. Let's go now to Grant's tomb. The tailor looked at his watch. It was getting late, he thought. I poured myself a nightcap, picked up the first, second, and third bases, and looked at the parrot, which was still awake because they had forgotten to put the hood over the cage. It's been a wonderful evening, I said, shaking hands all around, shaking hands with the maid, too, by mistake. You must come and see me when I get back to New York. I have a townhouse and a country house, you know. The weather is excellent in the fall when the smoke is cleared away. They're building a new dynamo over near Spite and Dival. It runs by ether waves. The rice was excellent, too, tonight, and the cognac. Good night. You know, I'm sorry I didn't know about this recording business earlier. It's a new medium for me, and I realize I've been rather awkward and self-conscious. As a matter of fact, I'm going to imagine now that I have a couple of drinks on my belt. It's relaxing and lenitive, as they say. There's one thing I realize. Every medium has its own laws. And you've got to respect those laws. I don't think that one really ought to read from his own writings. One ought to just stand up and create on the wing, as it were. Now, I think a lot of people are going to be disappointed with these readings. I am myself, in a way. I feel apologetic about it. In the first place, in the last place, too, I guess, the thing that hits me hardest is that the sound of my own voice is monotonous to me. It sort of puts me to sleep. I guess it'll put everyone to sleep. But I'm going to do better, I promise you that. I'll get a machine of my own, and after I practice a bit, I'll give you a warm, natural, spontaneous something or other about that great writer, that favorite writer of mine, Blaise Cendrars. He's not only a great writer, he's a great human being. But don't forget, Louis, the next time when I make a recording, have something good for me to drink, will you, while I'm doing it. But now that we're all through recording, I want to tell you what a wonderful experience it's been. Of course, it always is a great experience when you tackle a new medium. You not only learn something about the medium, you learn something about yourself. One of the first things I discovered, incidentally, is how monotonous is the sound of one's own voice. I'm thoroughly sick of it. Of course, it's one thing to sit down to a typewriter and, with God for your audience, you might say, and write. It's quite another thing to talk into the microphone. There's nobody in the room, you're all alone, just as you're all alone when you write. Nevertheless, you have the feeling that there are millions of ears out there. They're all hanging on trees, it seems like the leaves and boughs. And that enters into the whole thing and affects you. It's a physical thing as well as a mental thing. You see, in this damn medium, I feel that if you sneeze or cough or laugh, it's all right. It's okay. It belongs. Everything that has to do with transmission, with the human voice, is involved. In writing, you're really practicing all kinds of mediums when you're writing. That is, you're infringing upon other mediums. And in speech, there's a more direct contact. It's immediate, naturally. It has to go over. It has to register immediately. If it doesn't, it's a failure. Now, reading from one's own text, I'm firmly convinced of it now. Even if I were the greatest writer in the world, if I were Homer or Dante or Shakespeare, I'd still say, don't do it over the microphone. Do it at home. Do it alone. Do it on the typewriter. But don't try and speak it, because you'll only become a sort of a ham actor. You're only echoing yourself, and it's a parody and a travesty. There's something almost too sacred about the feeling you have when you sit down to write. Now, when you speak into a microphone, it's impersonal, and yet it is, as I said before, quite personal. There seems to be a paradox there. If you were addressing a mob in the flesh, outdoors, on a soapbox, that would be quite a different thing again. There you see everyone. You watch how it's affecting them, what you say. You can change it and alter it. In this studio room, before this little instrument, which is a frightening one, by the way, I must tell you, it gives you the creeps. You don't know what the hell's happening out there with those people who've got their ears glued to the, whatever it is, I don't know, the apparatus, what the hell it's called, I don't remember. But anyhow, everybody seems to be, he's plugged in, his ears are all plugged up, and you're talking through those wires and those contraptions, and you got to get clear of that maze somehow, and you got to speak to them as though you were out in the open air under the sun and the leaves shining and all that sort of thing, and yet you're just locked up in a room. That's what's creepy and eerie about it. You've got to believe that it's going to register, whether it does register or not, and in that way it does somehow once again link up with writing. Because when you write, too, you got to hear what you write, even though you didn't make a sound, even if the typewriter were a noiseless one. It has to make the sound of words in your head. But words, somehow, when you write them, you can paint them, or you can use them musically, or you can make them graphic, you can be dramatic, you can do all sorts of things. And you can't do that over the microphone. That's what I'm getting at. This damn thing has its own laws, and I'm only beginning to get it now. And if I'd only been able to spend, say, another 10 days with you, and you had lots of good things to drink, don't forget about that, and we had all kinds of good things to eat, too, I think we could really knock out something. I think I could compose something, especially for this apparatus. There ought to be speeches or records, whatever you call them, made just for the microphone, huh? Or for the recording, for the tape, let's say. That's what it is, the tape. It's about the flimsiest, most perishable thing there is. I see you, I'm making a speech, and you tell me at the same time I'm erasing one. Who ever heard of such a thing? It's a contradiction in itself. Do you see what I mean? I'll tell you something. Did it ever happen to you that you met a man who outsmarted you, outtalked you? You spent the whole evening in a state of frustration. You wanted to say something, and you open your mouth, and you begin, and he shuts you up. He outtalks you. He's faster than you. He gets the bead on you. Well, you know, sometimes you go home after an evening like that, and the funniest thing in the world happens. You go to bed, and you remember every damn thing that happened. And all those places where you were shut up, where he got the draw on you, so to speak, now you sing out beautifully. You know, you give him just the right answers. You're bright, the bright repartee. Well, I'm thinking, you know, on a night like that, what a wonderful thing it would be to have this bloody machine here alongside the bed. You just switch the light on, and then you'd prop yourself up on an elbow, and you'd begin to talk to that guy, huh? You see, usually that happens to you, or at least it happened with me that way, when you're in a foreign country and you only know a language moderately or not even that well, let's say, you can understand everything, but you can't speak it well. Well, of course, you're in a horrible predicament in a case like that. And the funny thing is, you come home that night, and even if you only knew, say, 500 words of French or Bulgarian or Turkish, whatever the hell it would be, suddenly you'd find yourself talking Turkish like a, well, what is it, like a shah, you know? You could say any damn thing in the language. You could even use the gerundive and the subjunctive mood and all those things. Sometimes we say about a man that he's fallen in love with the sound of his own voice. That's another one of those paradoxes. Because really, I don't think a man hears his own voice. But what we mean is, I think, that those men know that they will produce a certain effect when they begin to talk. They anticipate it when they open their mouths. They're what you call enchanters and seducers. They hypnotize one. Now, all my life, I think, the men I really enjoyed most, they belong in two categories. One is the clown, who doesn't use the human voice at all, the pantomimist. And the other is the talker, the natural-born talker, especially the comedian. And I might even localize it still more and say the vaudeville comedian or the burlesque comedian. Or take a modern one like Danny Kaye, the double talker. Those men are my meat. I go haywire when I hear them. It's a long swing from that to convey what I'm getting at. But this whole experiment has gotten me to thinking and believing more strongly than ever that we're not going to be reading books very many more years. It wouldn't surprise me that in another 50 years, there won't be any more books. We'll have this direct communication with one another. We might not even have to talk into a microphone then. We might not need records or tape or anything. We might have that wonderful thing happen, like a miracle, and I can see it happening. That when a man feels like creating, he'll just create, and maybe he won't even open his mouth, but it'll register, and it'll register on everyone. It won't be exclusive. You won't have to buy a book or join a club or any of that sort of thing. The real, spontaneous, creative act will be communicated universally, simultaneously, instantaneously. That would be a wonderful thing. And now we're in a sort of intermediate stage. We're breaking away from that cold, dead print, which is full of phony stuff. I've written a lot of words, millions of words, I guess. And I think today, more than ever in my whole life, I realize how useless and unnecessary were a lot of those words. Certainly when I repeat them, when I tell them over again in a recital, I see that they don't belong. They weren't necessary. The only thing that was necessary was what those men have that I spoke of a moment ago, who are in love with the sound of their own voice, the ability to transmit, to communicate what they have effectively and instantaneously, to have a sort of charm, to hypnotize. After all, what the hell, what is poetry? What was the great poetry that we only know now by some distant reverberation through printed books? What was Homer? He wasn't something written in a book. He was a man singing his words. He was a blind man, they say, wandering like a beggar. And wherever he went, he was creating a poem, a song. Somebody wrote it down. That's made a different kind of music. When you come today to men like T.S. Eliot and Auden and Spender and all the modern poets, even Mario Rilke, I don't care who you mention, there are long, long ways from those magicians of old, those wizards who had the verbal faculty. Let's get back to that. That's what I say. Okay, Louie, that's all.